Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, and that means a brand new episode of Graphic Policy Radio. This is the show that dares to mix comics and politics. It's a show for folks who wonder if those same world leaders who worry about the NSA spying also worry about Superman eavesdropping on them. Tonight, I'm flying solo, your host Brett, but I've got two guests joining me, Nick Justice and John Carroll, the creator, artist, and writer of Jesus E. Lee, a comic out from Blue Water Productions. Is he Jesus? Is he Robert E. Lee? Is he both Jesus E. Lee? Fights to defend Richmond, Virginia from the evil onslaught of Angel Eyes. So witness the miraculous and more with the modern retro thrill ride. So welcome, John and Nick. How you guys doing?
Doing good, Brett.
I'm doing well. This is Nick. How you doing?
Good, good, good. I'm guessing, Nick, you might be in Richmond going by the accent.
I'm from Virginia.
Okay.
Southern native, I'm currently living in New Jersey.
Ah, all right. It was a little off. So let's start with you, Nick. So I know a little bit on the history of Jesus E. Lee, but I think that's probably a good place to start. So, you know, where did you come up with the concept? It's kind of a pretty interesting thing mixing these two concepts that are so far apart.
It started out in my second year of Kubert School. It was one of our assignments to come up with a creator-owned product and create a costume and a little story to go along with them, see how far we could take it. And the instructor was going around, and he said, if you're drawing a blank, you know, throw two controversial characters together or mix two names together. And I was jotting down names, you know, thinking, okay, Jesus, and I'm from the South, so let's throw in a Civil War character. I jotted down Jesus E. Lee. The teacher comes by and taps on the paper that I was writing on. He says, that's it. Run with that. So that was it was as simple as that to start out with. But, of course, John is writing it, has taken the material far beyond whatever I could have imagined to do with it. And I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, happened. I know, Nick, you started with the first issue. It was a Kickstarter project in 2011. But with the second issue, John came on, and then you had a colorist, I believe, of, I'm going to fumble the name, Christian Ruiz, who helped and joined the team. So how did that go about?
John, you want to?
Yeah, sure, I'll take that one. Kind of one of those circuitous things that sort of happened. I was actually working on a story with Gavin, your roommate, Nick? When you had Kubert? Yeah.
Gavin? We were not roommates, just classmates.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was working on a story with Gavin Smith, who's a friend of Nick's. He's the artist on The Accelerators from Blue Juice now. If you've read that, it's a good book. He, I guess, like halfway through working on my story, he was doing the pencils for a story I did in an anthology on the Mirror World Forum. He needed to bring on an inker, which was Nick. And Nick and I actually really hit it off because we have a lot of, we're about the same age and we enjoy a lot of the same old school artists, like Ross Andrew. I think we had hour conversation about how awesome Ross Andrew is. For those youngins in the audience who even know who Ross Andrew is. And I was just spitballing ideas. Oh, you should do this, you should do that. Because two things that I really enjoy are American history and religion. And Jesus really blends them together nicely. And at some point, Nick was like, dude, just write it. And I was like, okay, sure. And that's kind of just snowballed from there.
Nice. So back up. We talked about Kickstarter a lot. I mean, how did the whole project go? And generally, like, what advice would you have for folks who are leading their comic careers Kickstarter?
Well, it doesn't hurt to go to conventions with your portfolio if you're an artist, and make as many contacts as you can. Make not only with working professionals, but at comic book stores. And the people that run the stores, they may have connections. The more people you get to know, the more you network, the better off you'll be. And so I went into the Kickstarter. Being in school at the time I started the Kickstarter, I guess it gained a little momentum just the location and me being where I was at, and busting my hump. So
nice.
Yep. That's.
And then you guys are published by Blue Water, and I know a lot of folks, you know, getting with any publishers is a huge momentous thing. So how did that come about? Because it seems to be a very popular thing where Kickstarter is almost like a testing ground for properties for publishers.
Well, since I already had the first issue where I had written and, you know, illustrated it myself from, you know, beginning to end, I had that in the can, and I drew four biography comic books for Blue Water, going through the paces. The first was like an Arianna Huffington biography, then one actually on the Tea Party, and the Arizona Senator Gabrielle Giffords.
Giffords, yeah.
And the last one I did was on Elizabeth Taylor. And I just kept pestering Darren Davis, the president and publisher at Blue Water. I said, look, he already had the PDF file, the digital file of the comic. I had sent that to him already, of Jesus E. Lee. And he said, sure. Would you like to do more than one issue? And I said, yes. So he was initially impressed, I think, with my speed and capability, never having to really spoon-feed me. Once I got a script, I ran with it, and you get a broad knowledge going to the Kubert School, so I guess that accounts for some of my speed, and he took it on and did four issues so far.
Nice.
So I'm having fun with it. I guess John is too.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
For both of you, I mean, you know, you Nick went to the Kubert School, so, you know, it's probably a indication of this. I mean, when you were younger, you know, writing or drawing comic books, was like that your goal in life? Is that something you always wanted to do?
Oh yeah, I mean, it was one of those childhood dreams. My mom would rip open large brown shopping bags, paper bags, and put them on the floor, and I could spend a day. The whole day they wouldn't have to babysit me because the crayons and the paper bags were my babysitter. You know, that and Super Friends and the Amazing Spider-Man cartoons and the Hulk cartoons of the 80s and He-Man and things like that. So, you know, it was something I always heard. Oh, Nick, he'll grow up to be a comic artist. And so that's what I wanted to do. And, of course, I didn't necessarily go down that path after high school. I didn't really pursue it. I didn't know how. But, so I was working in prison, actually, for several years, and I said, hey, I want to go back to art school. I recalled always seeing the Kubert School ads in the comic books. So I applied, and that's all she wrote, from Virginia to New Jersey. And I've been here since 2008.
Right. It's almost like electing to Luther Strode without all the violence.
What about the violence?
Yeah, where he sends away for the bodybuilding book from the comic book ad.
Yeah. I'm having a little trouble understanding. I can't.
Yeah, little garbled, John.
And I, hold on, let me see if it's better when I go on speakerphone.
Yeah, hold on. I'm going to ping you on IM. Just, yeah, if you got a non-speakerphone or something, that would be probably good.
Better?
A little.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. A little bit better. Well.
Okay. Sorry.
That's all right.
For me, it was kind of the same thing as far as what you were saying about wanting to draw comics. But for a very long time, you've been into comics. And I originally wanted to be an artist, but my art is literally even approaching the level of mixed early stuff. And what I really enjoyed more was the storytelling aspects of the writing, so I decided to focus on that. And like Nick, I kind of, you know, went other paths in college, and then pushing through, I decided I would give it a try again. So I started writing some scripts. And fortunately, I managed to get a couple of them actually illustrated, which is actually the big thing if you're going to be a comic book writer is to be able to actually get stuff drawn by somebody.
Yeah, how'd you go about getting someone to draw? I mean, that's a, you know, with things like DeviantArt now, it's a lot easier. Especially with like a new writer, like how did you approach someone to kind of get out there and make that happen?
It's really, really difficult. In my case, a lot of it, I don't want to say that it was luck, but there was a good deal of that involved. I mentioned the Fistful of Comics, which was the anthology that Nick and I first worked on together. He was the anchor on the story, I was the writer. That is just something that one of the guys over on Mark Miller's forum decided. He went to a panel at a convention on how to break in, and someone said, look, just, you know, go out and try to get people together to do an anthology. So that's what he did. He just basically said, look, it says we don't have enough, you know, money necessarily to pay artists to draw a 22-page comic script, but, you know, if people want to get exposure, let's all get together. We'll do 5 to 6-page stories. We'll put them out, and then we'll all have something that we can show to editors. And it kind of worked from there. I got that story in, and that was sort of the beginning.
I can understand you much better now, John. Whatever you did, you sound a lot better. I got every word of that. So. Yeah, that was a cool project to work on. I mean, that inking Gavin's work, and he's, you know, drawing the accelerators for Blue Juice, like John already mentioned, and yeah, that was our first team up, John and I, and he's been writing Jesus Ely with me ever since. Well, I should say for me. He really writes it. He'll send a script to me, and I'll be like, yeah, that's good. That's the extent of it. I'd never make any ridiculous corrections or anything, because what he writes is really so good, and it makes me want to. I just want to hop right in and draw it.
So it's actually it's a good question with and goes right into that. So with your collaborative work, like how does it actually work? I mean, and Nick, you create the character in kind of this world, or at least some of the world. Do you let John just kind of like go with it, or do you lay out and being like, hey, this is kind of what I'm envisioning for the direction of this story arc? You know, what would you do with it? Like, how does it actually work between you two?
First issue was like that. It was my baby. But then I was like, John, take it, do what you will. If I had any kind of complaints or anything, I would voice them to John. But I haven't yet, because like I said, he's doing things I would never think of to do. So I'm completely happy with that.
and John, I mean, like, I was gonna say, like, how does it feel for you, you know, handling someone else's creation? Because I know there's definitely got to be a vibe doing your own thing versus something someone else created.
Well, no, it's sort of funny that you mentioned that, because, you know, it seems kind of weird when you think about it in those terms, but really I think almost every comic book writer, I wouldn't say that everyone does, but almost every comic book writer has dreams that they want to work on Superman or Spider-Man, and those are characters that someone else created. They're not... Dan Slott didn't create Spider-Man. I mean, we can argue about, you know, what percentage Stan Lee or Steve Ditko had in it, but no one who's working on him now had anything to do with creating him. And I feel kind of like that. That's how I kind of approached it, as, like, I kind of think of this is a existing property that I'm working on, and it really is no different. I feel kind of beholden to people who, you know, admire Robert E. Lee, or, you know, have a certain degree of historical knowledge of the character and the fact that he was an actual real person, and, you know, people who have very strong feelings about Jesus. I kind of look at that as very similar to, and it being mixed creation, I look at that as very similar to what I think the mindset that you have to have if you're working on one of the big corporate characters is.
All right, that makes sense. You know, you just kind of mentioned it, you know, obviously people have strong opinions on Robert E. Lee or Jesus. And combining the two, I kind of read it and I was like, oh, this is just could be a hotbed of controversy. I mean, what has been the general reaction from folks? I mean, have you dealt with people who have been a little, we'll say, pissed about the character?
The only negative feedback I got was from my own grandmother, who happens to be an older conservative Christian lady, you know, and she was a little taken aback by it. She didn't know what to think, but I sat down and explained it to her. I said, "Now, Grandma, it's not sacrilegious. It's not intentionally meant to, you know, step on anyone's feelings." And Joe Kubert, actually in his class, because I took the project further, and that's where I drew a lot of issue one, was during his class, my third and final year of school. And he said, "Well, you know, Nick, this could be very controversial." And I said, "Yes, sir," but I didn't listen. And to a degree, I did, because the costume was different, so I toned down the costume and changed the costume a little bit. And if you look in the trade paperback that's out now, and the color edition's getting ready to come out of that, there's a few pages called the Dick Fistis Tijuana Bible. And that's one of the main characters that John further developed and integrated into the story. And his Jesus E. Lee's first costume had more of a Confederate rebel flag scheme going on, and I toned that way back and gave him more of a Captain America kind of feel to, you know, broaden the appeal and not single anyone out, because it's not meant to single anyone out, you know. Anybody should be able to read it and have a laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even just the Jesus aspect of it, but I would think even the Robert E. Lee aspect can, you know, depending on where you are, might bring about emotions. Then again, I might be giving people too much credit as their, you know, knowledge of history.
Maybe. I like some positive responses to it. I think more than negative responses have come from the Jesus and the Robert E. Lee.
Yeah.
Response is just some guy when I was showing at a Buffalo Comic Con told me he didn't know how to respond to it because he was a Christian. To which I thought, you have a problem with Jesus E. Lee, but you don't have a problem with Thor.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me that they'd be more angry with the one instead of the other. I was just kind of fascinated in the, what the reaction might be, because I can definitely see some people being a bit touchy. So let's go on with the Richmond. I mean, obviously, you know, with the Robert E. Lee aspect of it, Richmond is the perfect location setting. There's not many comics located in Richmond, so if any of them, how much. A lot of comics, the city is a character unto itself, and Richmond has a such like a rich history to it. You know, how much do you guys actually think about the city as a whole, its history, or even what it's like now when going about creating the stories?
Do you want to go that one first, Nick?
No, you go ahead, man. You're the writer. You can explain it better than I can.
I'm a competitive weak place because I want to get a lot of the stuff that you mentioned across. The problem being that I have spent some time in the South, but mostly in North Carolina and Maryland, which is sort of the South. But never actually very much in Virginia or Richmond. I don't think I've maybe driven through once or twice. So I'm very conscious of that. What I try to do is I try to do a lot of research, and obviously it does help that Nick is from Virginia. So that takes care of a lot of the physical description. Like, I can say to Nick, put this in, you know, a park somewhere in Virginia, in Richmond, and he kind of can fill in the details visually. Whereas it makes it very comfortable to work in, but I've never been there. I know that Nick can at least capture the feel of the city. I mean, I find that most cities, they're very not similar personalities, I'd say, but, I mean, I'm sure you know, Brett, what it's like living in Buffalo. And people become attached to the city. And I think that attachment is also the same. There are specifics that differ, but the basic attachment that people have to the city because that's their home don't really change from place to place. Like, New Yorkers have it. People in Buffalo have it. People in Virginia have it. People in D.C. have it. It's just really a matter of finding those specific landmarks. And that's where I would kind of rely on Nick a lot. One example is that I'll tease from our next issue that we're working on is Nick was talking to me and he was like, "Well, I really wanted Jesus E. Lee to live in the Jefferson Hotel." And I'm like, okay, well, we can do that. So I look up the Jefferson Hotel on Google, you know, check out a few pictures of it. I'm like, wow, it's like, this would be really awesome to trash in a fight scene. Keep it after that. I already have a scene that I'm working on right now that actually is set in the Richmond Hotel. And the nice thing, too, about the Internet is that even if, you know, I'm not familiar with stuff, I can find people who know stuff. Like, I've talked to a friend of mine for a story line I was thinking about doing in New Orleans that I'm still probably going to do. I was on Facebook with her for, like, an hour and a half just going into, like, just little things about New Orleans that would be detailed. Because it always really annoys me personally when someone gets, like, a real detail wrong. So I try to be as accurate as possible for that, mostly through research.
I would say with you, Nick, like, what about the actual art of it? I mean, do you, you know, some people just kind of go general, or do you actually look at, you know, photos and try to get it?
I'm not going to lie. Initially, there is a lot of generalization, like your typical backgrounds, typical buildings, typical whatever. But if there is something I do want to focus on, and I'll tell John about it, like we were just talking about the Jefferson Hotel. In the first issue, there's a specific canal wall that, you know, prevents flooding in the city, so I want to incorporate that into the story. Landmarks like that, certain buildings. There's a old train station that I incorporated into the art in the second issue. Things like that that I want people to, that are definitely from Richmond, if they read the comic, to, like, pick out, like, oh, I recognize that building, or that restaurant in the background, something like that. But I do want to trash the Jefferson Hotel, so. John says that's coming up, so.
What is it with the about that hotel that you want to trash it so bad?
Have you seen pictures of the inside of it?
Well, so the Jefferson, if I remember right, is the one with the Gone with the Wind, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah. So I've stayed at the Jefferson. And I've been drinking at the Jefferson, so I'm fairly familiar with the hotel. I mean, it's pretty extravagant.
Come on, all those columns and stuff, that's like tailor-made for a fight. Come on, getting people floating around and picking them up and screaming at people. I guess that's my genius. I look at the inside of the building and I'm like, how could I wreck this?
For people who don't know, Jefferson Hotel is actually like a really famous hotel. It's in Richmond, Virginia. And then Gone with the Wind, part of the movie was filmed in it, I think, as far as I know. So, the staircase was the model for the one during the Atlanta Mansion sequence of the film. So it has a lot of history to it. I mean, it's a very extravagant hotel, and if anyone's in the way, it's worth checking out.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, what could be his bat cave or his fortress of solitude within the city limits, you know, not secluded somewhere where no one can find it. He's right in the heart of the city, and he's
everybody
there.
And
everybody knows where he's at.
I mean, is there other things of Richmond itself that you guys talked about and said, you know, I really want to include this at some point?
Horses are challenging. Robert E. Lee actually had a horse named Traveler, so every now and then Traveler pops up. That's not a historical building or anything, but it's a...
Well, the funny thing with that horse is because I like keeping as much of the stuff from the first issue and Dick Fisk's Bible. I wanted to keep referencing them when you know, comics reference continuity all the time. It's one of the trends of comic books. And you'll notice that the horse doesn't show up from the beginning of my run until the end of the trade paperback, and that's because I kept forgetting to put it in. Like, I would finish the issue, and I was like, damn, I forgot the horse. The issue, I specifically put in the scene, I was like, I will get the horse in this issue by hook or by crook. Which I'm very happy that I finally did.
So, actually, I mean, this is you just talked about the trade, and it goes into the next question, or questions I wanted to talk about. There's a lot of talk of, I mean, you guys have been, you know, interested in the comics for a while. You know, I remember growing up, a lot of the comics, you could pick up one issue and you're done. And now there's very much like writing and creating for the trade. As creators, you know, how does that go through your mind in actually working out stories?
Well, for me, I know that everything is going to be collected eventually, and that's just one of the realities of the business. I think that the challenge is really writing something that can be enjoyed piece by piece and monthly or however frequently it comes out in installments. And at the same time, something that's going to read together as a whole, which I think is very different than, say, for example, writing what we were used to reading in the 80s, where they were writing, you know, maybe you'd have like a six-issue arc during the summer, and then it was bi-weekly, but for the most part, they would be done in around the maybe one, two, or three-issue stories. That doesn't necessarily read, especially now in the trade. And even if it's done, you know, particularly well, it feels sort of different from everything else. And I think when you're trying to write an indie book, it's you want to be different but not too different, because you're already kind of fighting an uphill battle for readership. You don't want to be like completely wrong or like something that's exactly like, you know, Stan Lee comics from the 60s, where each issue does work into the next but doesn't really go on a continued storyline necessarily. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And with you, Nick, I mean, the comic obviously is available on various digital services or sites. When it comes to doing art, I mean, is that now playing into your thought as an artist? I mean, I know a lot of folks are playing with things like Comixology's Guided View or, you know, how you would maybe break up panels or pages to make them a bit more optimized on phones or iPads. You know, how does that factor in for you as an artist, if it factors in at all?
For me, so far, it hasn't at all. I still approach every page the traditional way that I normally would. John has mentioned something about trying to attempt to do something like that, I think, at some point. But for now, I'm just approaching every page like I always have. Like, I get my Bristol board, and I've got this amount of space. I've got the script in hand. John has, you know, broken it down to panels and thorough descriptions of what the characters are doing, down to their facial expressions and how their body movement is. And so it's up to me to look up reference if I need reference and rough out everything. And typically, like, one thing you learn in school is to, in reading the script, what panel on that page has the most action going on or the most going on in it? Try to make that your largest panel, or find a panel that has some landscape, some scenery in it. An establishing shot is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Find an establishing shot and work from that. And sort of, for me, that's kind of where I start, and I branch out like the limbs of a tree, if you will, on the rest of the page. It just sort of flows from there.
But, you know, as an artist, are you looking at what others are doing? Is there anything that's kind of you thought about, oh, this might be kind of cool to include down the road?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, how can I lift this later? Nah. Nah, just all the artists I've always admired, most are thankfully still living and doing work now, so I'm always looking at new things. I'm always going back and looking at older work from older artists that I like. So not only am I collecting things that are new, I'm always keeping that one foot in history and getting the retro old school stuff too. Like one of my favorite artists is Bernie Wrightson, and he's been drawing since the late 60s, I guess.
Yeah.
I've recently gotten a big taste for Alex Toth.
So I'm
trying to work a little simpler, maybe, I guess, and do less line work and try to incorporate more black areas and white areas, because I've only recently gotten a great appreciation for Mike Mignola as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of artists I find I couldn't stand years ago for whatever reason, like, oh, their art isn't flashy enough or whatever. Now I've gotten an appreciation for them, and I'm trying to incorporate little lessons. I'll study their work, how did they approach this? What did they do in this panel? You know, so I can attempt my feeble attempt at trying to do the same thing.
So there was something, I think it was in the second issue. I mean, speaking of art and different styles, and it had like that dotted old school vibe to it. I think it was the second issue. You know, look wise, what made you guys decide to go with that in the series?
Do you mean the coloring itself, or
I'm pretty sure it was the coloring. It had like that old school dot sort of feel about it.
Oh, okay. That was actually the first issue.
Or first issue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was just me and lack of Photoshop skills, knowing how to color digitally. So okay. I tended to just flat everything and do minimal rendering, and then slap Photoshop effects over it because I really, you know, couldn't afford to pay anyone to color it for me, so I had to do it myself. And it just wound up being what it was. It made it a little more retro, I guess. But
yeah. Yeah, that was my thought of it. It had this really kind of a cool retro feel about it all. I really dug it.
And I was the only one in my class. Everyone else was doing a similar thing with their creator-owned projects as well. And I was the only one attempting to make it look older and attempting to make it look aged and retro like that. And everybody seemed to dig it, so I just did the whole book like that.
I don't think it would look a lot clearer if, like, we could be able to put it on flat paper. Because, like, the dots do not look as good on gloss paper because the gloss, like, interferes with it.
Okay.
Like, if you put them on paper, they look so much better.
Yeah, I would love for it to be on nasty, just...
newsprint.
Yeah.
It's like, smells like cigarettes.
Well, interesting. I read it digitally, and I thought it looked awesome as a digital copy. I was digging it because it's also something you just don't see much any day, you know, anymore. Which I think it stood out to me a little bit. I mean, have you thought about going back to maybe that a little bit, or are you kind of think you set with the current style?
Well, each issue has had its own. There's been a different colorist each issue, and each one has looked completely different, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and I like that about it. I don't know. There's no telling what we'll do. We're just in the beginning stages of the next issue, really. I mean, John's currently still in the progress of writing the script, and I'm within the first five pages of artwork. So we'd be jumping the gun to say exactly what we want to do with the coloring or lettering or anything like that at this point. That's a couple of months down the road.
So with that, I mean, you know, how long, with the first issue, how long did it take you to, from start to finish, to put it together?
Oh, wow. Since that was a solo project, it took me probably the entire second semester. I'd say probably 5 or 6 months, one-man project. And that's why I like the assembly line process now with John writing and...
That's why they use the assembly line process in comics, kids.
Yeah.
What about instead of
6 months, it takes maybe, if I really sit down and don't let life, the rest of life, get in my way, I could finish an issue and have it colored and lettered and everything inside of 2 or 3 months if I really, really pushed it.
All right. Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question is, you know, roughly how does it take, how long does it take to do issues now? So, I mean, you went through 4 issues, and the 4 issues came out pretty steadily. You know, how did you guys have that all in the can before the first one like came out from Blue Water, or were you doing it kind of at, you know, as things were being released too?
Issue 2 I think was the longest one, because issue 2 I think I actually finished the script for that like almost like a year and a half before it finally came out. Simply because I had done it for Nick, I think he was going to consider self-publishing. I had finished it, I had sent it to him, and then he had all the Blue Water work. So it took a while to get that done. And then after that, Blue Water picked it up, but then there was questions about the contract. So I believe that one actually took about a year and a half to 2 years to actually come out. The other ones, I think, will probably be at that kind of value, probably about like 3 or 4 months each, Nick. for 3 and 4?
Yeah, that's about right.
Four was the hardest one to write. Four, I think, took me the longest. I think 2 and 3, I think I wrote in about probably like 3 weeks. 4 took a lot longer because I kind of wrote myself into a corner at the end of 3, for those of you who have read it. And I had to write my way out in, I was trying to do it in under 30 pages. It is a little bit of a bumper-sized issue, simply because I had to get myself out of a really deep hole. One of the titles is not really necessarily doing a huge amount of structural planning before you start to write.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you admitted that you kind of put yourself in a hole. Obviously kind of the first arc wrapped up. You're clearly working on the next arc. How far do you plot out? Do you sit there and say, here's what we're doing for, the next 4 issues, and we're getting from point A to point B. Here are some couple things that I want to hit with each issue, or is it kind of like on the fly as you go? Because I know some people have, 20 or 30 issue plans. How far out?
For me, we have a pretty clear idea of what the next 4 issues are going to be. Nick and I have talked about this, but there's still a lot of reading there about exactly what's going to happen. But the next 4 issues are pretty solid of what we're going to do and what we're going to introduce and what's going to happen. Beyond that, I have ideas for this. I mean, we could be doing this until we're crotchety old comic book creators who are complaining about how Marvel or DC or whoever screwed us way back when and not producing much of anything. But as far as, concrete plans, usually about 4 to 5 issues out.
How specific are the plans, though? I mean, is it generally here's what we want to do? Or is it more like scripted out of, not even scripted out, but kind of outlined of, in this issue, this generally happens, in this issue, this generally happens, this issue, this generally happens?
Pretty much the arc, there's pretty much a plan for the arc, but I don't have individually for each issue plotted down in as much detail. What I kind of do is I kind of have, we're going to have this happening in the arc, and there's a very broad, overarching kind of idea. It's actually very similar if you, what I kind of steal a lot of my process for that is Jim Zeff, the guy that does Skull Kickers, has a great website with a lot of tutorials, and I kind of follow his kind of methodology in a lot of things. What I start with is basically, if you read his pitch for Skull Kickers, the first arc, it's always about that detail, where it's like, this is what's going to happen, it's like, these are the characters, they're going to do this, this is going to happen. That's the fourth arc, is basically what you would pitch if you were handing it to a publisher. Then I kind of, for myself, sort of break down the individual parts of it, where it's like issue 1 will get from point A to point B, issue 2 will get from point B to point C, issue 3 will get, and so forth and so on. And then I kind of break from plotting after that. After that, I pretty much just start writing the script. And a lot of the time, this isn't as interesting as I thought, or this takes up more time than I thought it was going to, and then stuff will move around at that stage.
All right, that makes sense. I know.
Can I add to that just a moment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just a little bit. John pitched one character to me that I just, I don't come up with all the characters. John, a lot of the supporting cast, John has created. Like the preacher in the third issue, and actually Kane himself in the second issue, those are totally John creations. And he has pitched a character to me, two characters that I really am itching to draw in the upcoming issues. So I hope I'm not going to drop any names, but it's going to be good. It's going to be good.
There's some crispy stuff coming. That's all I will say.
it's kind of interesting with nowadays, with fans having so much access to the creators themselves. I mean, with the interactions with fans or reviews? I mean, how much does that also weigh in on what you guys are doing? I've always kind of been fascinated by that because I know some creators get just beat down every day. You know, it's got to be, you know, highs and lows constantly dealing with that.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what people did before the internet, because how did they handle criticism? Was it all, you know, you waited for weeks at a time to get a letter in the mail, like fan mail, or... But now at the drop of a hat, you know, instantaneously you'll see comments online, or... So, there's an underground fan base for this, and they're pretty... It's a developing fan base, and they're pretty fanatical about it. So I think that's good. I mean, it's interesting. I'll tell you that much. Interesting.
I think the big thing is you kind of have to try to fine line when you're trying to create stuff between being responsive to what the fans want to see and at the same time telling the stories that you want to tell. Like, you want to cater to the fans but not necessarily pander to them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, don't, you know, a musician doesn't go into the studio and say, okay, I've got to do this to satisfy the fans. I think first and foremost, we have to be happy with what we're doing. And if the fans like it, or anyone else likes it, that generates a new fan, and the people that would be drawn to it will be drawn to it. If we build it, they will come, type of thing.
For fans that are listening, you can actually call in with your questions. I know I've been tweeting up the number. But for those that are listening that aren't in front of a computer, you can call at 619-768-2952, throw in your questions for Nick and John. Otherwise, I'm just going to hog all the time. so how far
actually,
out?
This is actually on now. I thought this was, like, being recorded for later.
No,
okay.
No, we're live.
Oh, wow.
We're doing it live.
I'm glad I've been able to watch my language. Good.
You don't have to. Clearly, you haven't listened to this radio, the show, because I usually drop F bombs here and there on each show. I mean, what advice would you both have for folks who want to get into the business? You know, what have you learned over the years, each of you, doing your kind of your respective thing?
Well,
I mean,
you can go first,
okay.
John.
I'm still thinking my answer. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm still at the bottom of the pecking order, still taking baby steps, and just because you're published, it doesn't necessarily mean instant stardom or whatever. So you can't let that eat you up and let that be your sole purpose for doing this. You don't get into it writing or illustrating, drawing, unless you're passionate about it. You got to love it and take it seriously. If it's a secondary career for you, like it is for me, you develop it and pound the pavement until eventually one day this thing, you know, snowballs into something bigger. And it's a struggle. And you have to be prepared for that. You have to be in the mud and the blood and the beer, so to speak. And we're in the trenches now. So, I mean, it's not a cakewalk. I can use all these cliches all night long. But I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah, most of you managed to just beat it. Do it. I mean, like, that's the thing is, when you go out of, you know, comic convention, you write and you go to panels on how to break into the industry, what everybody invariably tells you is you have to go out and you have to actually produce something. Like, you can't wait. The market is not at the place anymore where you can send in submissions to just about any publisher that they're going to print. You have to go out and, especially if you're a writer, you have to find artists to work with, and you have to actually get work out there. Don't wait for, you know, Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or anyone to come, you know, knocking on your door. Go, if you want to make comics, go out and make comics. And if you keep doing it long enough, you'll get good at it, And if you get good enough at it, if you're persistent and, you know, like patient and you're professional, you know, there's a good chance that something will happen for you. At least I hope that's true.
No, I mean, that's a lot of the advice that folks that we've had on the show seem to be about it is, you know, this isn't a, you're not going to become a millionaire doing this. You have to do it for the love of it, and you got to get out there and pound the pavement and actually, you know, give it a try. I mean, you know, speaking of conventions, I mean, how important do you think those are to get out there? I mean, getting to shops or just talking to the fans one-on-one for a creator to pitch. I mean, with the advent of the internet and Twitter and Facebook, you know, are conventions as important, more important, less important? What do you two think?
Well, I haven't done too many conventions as a creator. I mostly go as just, you know, someone who's going for the conventions rather than a table or anything. The first convention that I did was Buffalo Comic Con. I did that last weekend, the weekend before last. And that is definitely valuable. The thing that conventions do that's really good is they give you, they kind of reinforce why you're doing what you're doing. I have people come up and want your signature and they want to talk to you about stuff. Conventions are great for that. They're also getting your name out there. I think in terms of just going to talk to professionals, they're also very valuable because you can learn a lot about, you know, the craft. And you can also get positive reinforcement. Like, for example, I'll give an example from New York Comic Con. I'm very self-conscious about my dialogue. It's the one thing that I feel that I most need to work on as a writer. It takes me the most time doing anything. And it is very gratifying to talk to a professional writer whose work I admire, who looks into the dialogue, looks okay. I'm like, wow, it looks okay, that's great. Well, I'm still going to work on it, but it's nice not to have to look at it and say the dialogue sucks. It's a nice kind of shot. And conventions are great for that. I think in terms of networking, when you're starting out, they're probably not that important just because of Facebook and DeviantArt and all the forums. It's so easy to find people now.
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
I'm guilty of not attending conventions like I should. I've only done, so John is the one that does more networking than I do, and you know, I'm trying to pick myself up and start doing it more.
Jersey, because, you got no excuse. You got New York right there.
Yeah.
Wizard World.
I didn't go to New York this year. I haven't been to that in a couple of years, actually. It's just always a matter of not being able to afford to, or something else, you know, comes up, or I'm committed to something else. And this year I was actually, this month, every Saturday this month, I was instructing life drawing courses at the Kubert School, so that was kind of cool. So I couldn't, I'd already committed to that, so I couldn't go to the convention anyway, so. But I do plan on, I've already arranged to attend Baltimore next year, which I love the Baltimore show.
That's a great show.
And Richmond is actually having a show, a Wizard World in Richmond. So we're going to set up shop there. I'm going to try to get John down, whatever I can do to We're going to shack up in the Jefferson Hotel.
I will tell you what hotel not to stay down there. As much as the Jefferson is fantastic, I've been in one of the worst hotels I've ever stayed in is in Richmond as well. So it's a fun city. Actually, I might have to head down there if they're doing a Wizard World down there for that show. So hopefully we can all meet up. So how about a little speed round of some questions, you know, basically one-word answers, see what you guys have to say about this. Writer that you that influenced you the most?
Grant Morrison.
One word, like one name.
Like one writer. Name, yeah.
Wow. Hal Foster.
All right. What about artist?
Jack Kirby.
Eric Larson.
Interesting. Yeah, I could see some Larson influence in yours. That's a good one. What about a character you'd like to work on the most, other than, of course, Jesus Ely?
I'm going to say Spider-Man.
I would like to do something horror, so Swamp Thing.
All right.
Something like that.
I buy you Swamp Thing.
this is obviously not a one answer question, but I mean, do you guys currently read stuff that's coming out from other folks, or do you have just not enough time to do that? Because I've heard that from a lot of creators, where they're like, as soon as you get in on it, as much as you want to, you just feel like your ability to do all that just dives and disappears.
Unfortunately, I'm at the point where I'm not that busy that I can't afford to spend time to read stuff. I don't really read a lot of stuff that's coming out in single issues. I usually trade in. I'm currently working through, I bought all of the trades from Valiant at New York Comic Con. They kept me a really good deal, so I bought them all. I'm currently finishing up Harley's and Lowe's. They did run some fantastic stuff. The one comic that I do single issue out is the Dark Horse Star Wars. Like the Star Wars, and then it's based off of his original outline for the first movie, which is actually a really amazing book. And,
yeah,
of course, Skull Kickers and Six Gun are two great books that I really love.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm a single-issue kind of guy. If it's new material, I do my little weekly run, have my pull list. I definitely get Savage Dragon. That's my go-to book. I get that every issue. I'm getting Rachel Rising by, is it Terry Moore? Yes.
Yeah, great series that definitely does not get enough coverage by anyone.
And Fatale. I'm getting into a lot of things like that are noirish or that are off the beaten path. I definitely noticed that I'm collecting much more indie work, indie books than I am Marvel or DC recently.
Yeah.
If it's older material, I'll get it in trade or an artist edition, something like that. But I just got Volume 7 of Hal Foster's Prince Valiant, so I eat that stuff up and read those 2 or 3 times each. If you want to know how to draw something, go to the old masters like that and study it and look at it and try to emulate it.
Yeah, I love looking at the I've got some of the Titan old school Flash Gordon books.
Oh, yeah.
And the old strips, I just love checking them out and staring at them. Just beautiful art. You just don't see it nowadays. Great old school stuff.
Someone's doing a new collection of Flash Gordon that I want to get. It's got like the Flash Gordon strips, but then they've got like the other feature that Alex Raymond did that was like with the Sunday pages, like Jungle Boy or something like that. Like, it's supposed to, like, recreate the original way they appear in the Sunday pages. It's, like, the Jungle Girl strip, like, up in the top corner, and then the rest of the page is Flash Gordon. That just looks really cool. I'm not sure.
Well, we're kind of coming down to the top of the hour, so I want you guys time to plug up some stuff. If folks want to get Jesus E. Lee, check it out now, what's the easiest thing for them to do?
Go to www.leeds.comicfreemarket.com. If you go to our Facebook page, we have a Facebook page. It's www.facebook.com/adventuresofJesusEWee, because apparently there's actually a guy named Jesus EWee, so I couldn't just call it Jesus EWee. And all that information is all right up there as far as we post regular links to where you can get the stuff.
Is there, you've got a couple digitally different places. You got Comic Flea Market and Comixology. Yeah. You know, Comixology obviously has the guided view. Is for you two, is there a different experience reading the two?
I'm not a digital guy. I am a hard copy kind of guy all the way. So I get the hard copies, and that's it. I don't even know honestly, the reading experience people have with the digital format. If
right,
you like it, I'm happy.
Personally, I am not one of those readers. We don't like digital comics. I usually only use the guided view for something like Batman 66. But the guided view native, where it was like designed to make use of the guided view. I generally, when I'm reading a digital comic, if it's not designed for guided view, I would read it like a regular comic. Which is one of the reasons why you'll notice in the next issue there's almost no double page spreads, because they do not work well with a digital comic. So I kind of eliminated them from the new issue. Because it seems like a lot of our readers worry a little bit anyway.
Yeah, okay.
All right, that makes sense. Okay, so you're saying digital is influencing your writing somehow.
It's a very different influence of me, because I'm very conscious that if people are going to be reading this on a tablet or like their phone, if you're going to read it on your phone, there's really nothing I can do, because I'm not going to worry myself that much. But if you're reading it on a tablet, I'm trying to make it so that every page is legible on one page. I don't want to have information that needs to be displayed on like just to swap around your device so it goes in the landscape view, because I just find that to be extremely annoying.
I do have something to add to that.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it applies to digital. But in traditionally looking at a hard copy comic and when drawing the pages, let's say, for instance, you open up the book and you have page 2 and 3 beside each other, laying flat. You don't want, if it's not a two-page spread, you don't want page 2 and page 3 bleeding into one another. So use things like gutters and things to separate the panels from each other so everything doesn't bleed together and look like a big mess. You know, you want your eye to follow it, to be able to follow it from panel to panel, so divide those panels. And so you don't have pages, you know, looking, like I already said, looking like one page when they're not supposed to be.
Yeah. Sam said at a recent last year's New York Comic Con, but then he said this, but it's very true. The last thing that you want when you're writing or drawing something on a comic page is for the reader to even for a second have to think about what it is or what order the panels are supposed to go in. There should be like a logical continuity to every panel. And that's one thing that Rick is great at, because I've never had a problem trying to figure out where you're supposed to read. It's always very obvious in the way he lays out pages.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great flow to every issue. Well, cool. We don't only have a couple minutes left, so if folks want to catch you online, you plug the Facebook, where can they get you individually?
I've got my Facebook page. I do also have a Twitter. It is John Carroll, JohnCarroll, or actually, excuse me, it's Wright, it's not Wright, Write.
Right. Yeah, what about you, Nick?
I have a blog spot that I have been starting to utilize again, once again, since I don't frequent cons like I should. That's nickjusticeimaginationstation.blogspot.com. Extremely long title. That's NICKJUSTUS, Imagination Station, and that's my blog spot. nickjustice.deviantart.com if you want to check out my DeviantArt page. Typical email is nickjusticeart@yahoo.com. Nothing fancy, nothing too fancy.
Right. Well, I appreciate you guys coming on. It was great having you. So, thanks again, guys.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And with that, We are wrapping up another episode of Graphic Policy Radio. I want to thank Nick and John again. You can get Jesus Lee and Comixology Comic Flea Market. So you can check out Graphic Policy every day at graphicpolicy.com. And on social networks, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Pinterest, and more, all at Graphic Policy. So you can remember, listeners, just like Nick and John, if you have a dream, pursue it, make it happen. And with that, I'm Brett. Thanks for listening, and have a geeky week.